I've cut this a little to keep myself to the allotted 3 hours that Bob tells me is the normal lecture time here. John Crow Ransom, in speaking about Wallace Stevens' poem, Sea Surface Full of Clouds, describes it as having a remarkable complexity. And he says, to study it, if you do that sort of thing, is to be happy. And I'm assuming that you here like looking very closely at poems, because that's what I'll be doing with some of the poems here. I hope that you'll find my talk dense in the good sense of the word. I'm interested in the voice effects of poetry, the sense you have of a speaker talking the poem or singing the poem. And I'm interested in the musical effects of the poetic voice, rhythmic effects and rhyme. And above all for today, the way the voice pauses when we speak for expressive purposes. The talk is called Voice as Metaphor, Silences, Sighs, Ellipses, O's, and Ahs, to give you some sense of what I have in mind. In his line, as if we saw our feeling in the object seen, Wallace Stevens succinctly describes two essential aspects of metaphorical language. This is an important first line, so I'll read it again. In his line, as if we saw our feeling in the object seen, Wallace Stevens succinctly describes two essential aspects of metaphorical language. One, there is a perceived correspondence between an inner subjective feeling and an outer physical reality, an object. The perceiver is aware that this correspondence does not exist except in his as-if assertion of its existence. Metaphorical seeing always involves making believe, and the awareness, somewhere on the fine line between consciousness and subconsciousness, that one is making believe, so that the projection of a feeling onto an object can take place. When one sees a beautiful sunset, for example, one sees the beauty of the sunset as if the beauty were inherent in the sunset itself. Thus the phrase, a beautiful sunset, is in effect a metaphorical statement. Metaphorical language is so natural to ordinary speech that usually one is not aware of it as such. When one says, she is a cold woman, one does not expect to touch her, she's 36 degrees Fahrenheit. Or when grandma says to grandson, you are so sweet that I could eat you, we can trust that the grandson already has a sense of metaphor and knows not to take that literally. The listener knows without being warned that cold and sweet are not to be taken literally. They describe subjective feelings about people that are assumed to correspond to physical experience. Robert Frost's description of metaphor, like Stevens' description, emphasizes the connection of inner and outer. Frost says, it is just saying one thing in terms of another, matter in terms of spirit, or spirit in terms of matter, to make the final unity. This unity may be further described as one of place and or of world and mind. and it cannot exist without its expression in language, so that the felt, experienced correspondence of feeling and object depends on the metaphor that brings the two together. Frost calls this unifying effect of language a gathering metaphor. The gathering power of a poem is its design, which may be thought of as a metaphor since it holds together and extends in complexity and nuance the various metaphors that the poem contains. Yet as a structure of words, the poem is metaphorical in another way. The words themselves on the page become an object, and to vary Stevens' line, it is as if in reading them, we hear our feelings in the sounds of a human voice that sounds a human voice would make in speaking them. Every poem creates the illusion of a speaking human voice, and the reader may choose to think of that voice as belonging to an invented character or to the poet himself. But even if the latter assumption is made, the poet through selection has represented only an aspect of himself, one mood among many, and thus has fictionalized himself. The feelings that the poem has verbal structure invites the reader to project upon the poem are never only the feelings appropriate to the subject of the poem itself, feelings such as sorrow, regret, sympathy. Inseparable from such subjective emotions is the pleasure of the poem, as object. No matter how sorrowful the subject matter of a poem, a good poem will not make a reader feel sad. The reader does not experience sorrow, but the poem of sorrow, the poem of sorrow. Even though the reader is reminded that indeed real sorrow does exist in the world. As Auden expressed this paradox of pleasure and poetic sorrow, he says, "Oh, happy grief is all sad art can say." The reader experiences the illusion of a human voice, knowing that it is an illusion, and therefore he experiences the voice as metaphor. The implied voice qualities of the written words, tone, pitch, speed, roughness, or melodic ease, are an essential part of the poem's gathering design, which can evoke the sense of human presence. The essence of metaphor, then, is not merely the correspondence between inner and outer, between subject and object, but rather the verbal design itself that holds the two together. For the design is always more than the kinds that it makes. Metaphorical design always evokes a sense of mystery, a mystery of connectedness and connection, and in particular, the mystery of language, without which the connections of inner and outer do not exist at all. The essence of metaphor, seen in this way, is innuendo, implication, and the awareness of possibility. Preceding language and idea is the cry of the human body, the body's voice of sounds without words, and both our cries and words are preceded by silence and followed by silence. Yet silence too may become articulate because of the context in which it is placed, like a musical rest note. We hear the silence of a rest note because it is contained within the musical phrase. In this sense, the mystery of the evocative power of metaphor may be compared to the delineated silences, the pauses within a poem that are suggested by a shift in rhythm, for example, or a line break, or a stressed syllable when two syllables are expected to complete a metric foot. The metaphorical center of a poem may often be found in the implications of its silences. Now I want to begin to illustrate some of these general points by looking at Frost's poem Hyla Brook, which I'll read to you. Hyla Brook. By June, our brooks run out of song and sought for much after that. It will be found either to have gone groping underground and taken with it all the Hyla breed that shouted in the mist to go, that shouted in the mist a month ago, like ghost of sleigh bells in a ghost of snow, or flourished and come up in jewel weed, weak foliage that is blown upon and bent, even against the way its waters went. Its bed is left a faded paper sheet of dead leaves stuck together by the heat, a brook to none but who remember long. This, as it will be seen, is other far than with book brooks taken otherwhere in song. We love the things we love for what they are. In Robert Frost's Hyla Brook, for example, we are listening to a brook that has lost its song. The poem, in effect, is a response to and a celebration of the silence of the brook. The poem opens with the implication that there is a specific listener for this poem, since the speaker refers to our brook, and that intimate hour suggests the auditor may be his wife. By the last line, it becomes manifest that this is indeed a poem about the strengthening of the bond of love through the mutual metaphorical viewing of an object in nature, just as the woman says in another Frost poem, West Running Brook, as you and I are married to each other, we'll both be married to the brook. We'll build our bridge across it, and the bridge shall be our arm thrown over it asleep beside it. Hyla Brook, too, possesses two qualities which are named as song and speed. Its speed is literal, a material quality, but the quality of song is not inherent in the brook itself, and thus necessarily implies a subjective beholder. Literally, brooks do not sing. They are perceived as if they were singing by a beholder who projects the idea of song upon the brook's random sounds. The poem moves backwards in time, for it is a poem about seeing the past, the signs of which have physically vanished, so that absence comes to represent a past presence. The absence of the brook, its invisible silence, paradoxically is seen and heard in June. And this absence evokes the brook as it was in early spring when the Hyla frogs were there. And it also evokes further back in time the ghostly remembrance of winter, a ghost of sleigh bells and a ghost of snow. The brook moves one way and the weeds another, just as the speaker's mind both remembers and looks ahead to the future. Again, as in West Running Brook, love is defined as having the power to embody and affirm contraries, male and female, past and present. It must be the brook can trust itself to go by contraries the way I can with you and you with me, Frost says again in West Running Brook. All the speaker actually sees in Hyla Brook from June on is a bed of dry leaves. Someone not familiar with this landscape would not see a brook at all. He would not know that the Hyla frog ever lived there. Only by virtue of memory, by cherishing what has been there before, can the mind bring to the eye what is now gone, and thus give body to absence. As Frost says, a brook to none but who remember long. Filling the silence, seeing into the past, are then projected into the future as a bond of understanding between the speaker and his wife. Frost is giving the reader a lesson on how to surpass literal sight, as he assures us, this as it will be seen is other far than with brooks taken otherwhere in song. For the bond between the man and the woman in this poem requires that the past be contained even in the radically changed present and continued into the future. This is precisely what ongoing love must accomplish. Frost is teasing his reader with a subtle boast, saying in effect that any other poet would write a poem about a brook that is a brook, but I, Robert Frost, have the wit to write a poem about a brook that is not a brook, a brook that only can be seen by someone who knows the landscape well enough to remember its seasonal past. In order to love a brook that is no longer a brook, the speaker must incorporate the past as if it still existed into the way he sees the dead leaves stuck together in the heat, so that the absent brook can become a metaphor evoking the hope for the continuity of love. The poem's final line, "We love the things we love for what they are," which seems so solidly committed to literal and factual reality, now can be seen otherwise as reverberant with innuendo and implication. The brook is both what it once was, a brook, and what it is now, not a brook, but dead leaves stuck together. Thus, to love things for what they are must include loving them as well for what they are not, for what they once were, and for what they still may be. Reality cannot be fixed in a declarative, they are. What things are for Frost is what the mind can make of them, as if this sonnet song itself were written on a faded paper sheet. The physical brook is transformed through the poet's singing voice into a metaphorical brook, which continues to flow in the speaker's memory, the mind's underground, so that the last line may be read finally as a kind of promise the speaker makes to love his wife, even when they are not physically together, even into the silence that follows their speech. Let me read Wallace Stevens' The Snowman to you and continue the discussion of silence and absence. The Snowman. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost in the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, as a typo there, and have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Wallace Stevens' The Snowman is also a poem about beholding what is not there. Yet unlike Frost's speaker, who seeks to remember the spring season in June, Stevens' Snowman attempts to see only winter image in the winter landscape, as if the world could be observed objectively, like a physical fact. The snowman resists all metaphorical thinking. He will not allow himself to hear the wind as if it were expressing any human feeling like misery. He wishes to behold the landscape as it is, adding nothing of himself to what he sees. When Blake said, "We are led to believe a lie when we see with, not through the eye," he defined in wholly negative terms the winter mind of Stephen Snowman, who sees with the eye. For to see with the eye is to perceive the world as an object apart from the beholding self. To see through the eye, however, is to perceive the world with one's mind, to associate objects with feelings and ideas, to behold the landscape as metaphor. Stevens, like Blake, is a celebrator of the imagination, seeing through the eye. Yet Stevens is sharply aware of how easily metaphor passes over into fantasy or illusion. For this reason, seeing with the eye, with the winter mind, is a necessary corrective or balance for the imagination. For Stevens, the literal eye provides the mind with a constant reminder of external reality. Just as there are two ways of perceiving reality, with and through the eye, there are two observers in Stevens' poem, a snowman who sees only what is objectively present, and a narrator-observer who regards the snowman and is keenly aware of what the snowman is not thinking. This subjective narrator-observer beholds not only the visible, but the invisible as well. For him, the idea of absence and silence has its own being and content, so that his language approximates winter stillness in the steadily repeating syllables that hiss through the poem, expressing silence of a sort, as Stevens says elsewhere. Although The Snowman seems to be a poem about total winter desolation, it is of particular significance that the scene is filled with evergreen trees and that it has its own pristine beauty, free of the mind's association of misery with wind and coldness. Furthermore, the month is January, the commencement of a new year and the turning towards spring. In effect, Stevens suggests that this is not to be seen as a poem merely about the diminished mind of the snowman, who can no longer make any human connections with the landscape, but about a beginning as well. In order for the mind to begin again, however, to perceive the landscape in a human way, it must imagine energetically the ending of the imaginative effort that preceded it. As Stevens says in his poem, The Plain Sense of Things, the absence of imagination had itself to be imagined. I'll repeat that. Stevens says, the absence of imagination had itself to be imagined. For the poem's narrator, imagining the snowman's winter mind is the necessary imagining of the absence of imagination. The snowman hears monotonous sound, almost like silence itself. But from the narrator's point of view, there is a paradoxical fullness to this description of emptiness, which the winter scene is evoked as being full of the same wind. The snowman sees things as things, facts as facts, objects as objects, but to the more imaginative mind of the narrator, objects may also be seen as metaphors, and therefore for him, to perceive winter as an objective physical fact, not as a symbol of misery, but tokens of failure of the imagination. Yet the intractable sound of the wind, merely itself, only once removed from silence, must also be confronted. The snowman is the best perceiver of nothingness that does indeed exist as an aspect of physical being. As close as we can get to the sense of silence in the repetitions of the sounds of sameness and monotony, so too do we approach unmediated reality as we postulate independent existence prior to any metaphorical imposition upon it. Nevertheless, Stevens' whole poem becomes a metaphor, since absence, when well imagined, encompasses its opposite, the presence of the idea of absence, the idea of non-being. The poem's narrator, then, beholding the snowman, realizes that, by implication, that perception is nothing, it is empty, until human associative thought transforms objects into metaphors. But this nothing does exist. It is, as Stevens says, the nothing that is, though only the narrator, not the snowman, can possess this knowledge. What the snowman sees is what the narrator knows, for the narrator encompasses the idea of nothing, and that quickens his desire for the renewal of metaphorical perception. As Stephen says in a later poem, "And not to have is the beginning of desire." This renewal of desire for metaphor is suggested by the approach of the distant sun as the year turns towards spring. With the realization that nothing must be confronted, we hear a kind of gasp, a flash of silence, one might say, in the penultimate line, the only line in the poem that ends with an enjambment. Only through metaphor can the absence of metaphor be imagined. A world without metaphor is nothing. Yet this is true for Stevens in both a literal and a metaphorical sense. And thus the poem both partakes of silence and is about silence. Silence as natural fact and silence as possible. Human reality, emotion, mood, need, cannot be expressed denotatively as fact, because it always is changing, fluid, open to further possibility. Human love, for example, is composed as much of memory and hope as it is of physical desire. Love is an idea of obligation and responsibility wedded to, inseparable from, a bodily need for touch. As Yeats said, love would be no more than an animal hunger but for the poet. We read William Blake's "Never Seek to Tell Thy Love." Never seek to tell thy love. Love that never told can be, for the gentle wind does move silently, invisibly. I told my love. I told her all my heart, trembling, cold, and ghastly fears. Ah, she doth depart. Soon after she was gone from me, a traveler came by, silently, invisibly, he took her with a sigh. William Blake's poem, "Never Seek to Tell Thy Love," relates a story about a traveler's amorous wooing sigh, and is itself the sigh of the rejected narrator after he has failed to win the lady with the direct declaration of his love. In contrast to the blunt and forthright narrator, the traveler's sigh is the epitome of language as suggestion and connotation. Blake implicitly compares human breathing with nature's breathing, the gentle wind, and thus conveys either the emotions of the narrator and the traveler in terms of how the poem breathes evenly or catches its breath through rhythmical shifts. The radical metrical interruption in the refrain line, silently, invisibly, for example, characterizes the interrupted breathing, the sigh, the anxiety of the narrator, and also suggests his subconscious identification with the traveler. The narrator begins urgently. Almost all his lines start with stressed syllables, "Never seek to tell thy love," and a strong rhythmic pattern quickly is established. But that pattern breaks abruptly in the fourth line, silently, sigh, invisibly. The two missing stresses in this poem of four beats per line must be read into the caesura in the middle of the line. In the comma, musical rest note, we hear a doubly stressed pause, a sigh, an intake and exhalation of breath, invisible and approaching silence. The narrator is compared to the easy movement of nature itself in the figure of the gentle wind, which provides us with an image of nature's breathing, open and ongoing, in contrast to the narrator, who seeks to limit love and definitively telling all his heart. Love is destroyed, Blake implies, by placing it within mental boundaries, by trying to capture it. As Blake says elsewhere, he who bends to himself a joy does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. The woman who hears the narrator's declaration of love is aghast because love has been limited in its unmetaphorical, and we hear her dismay echoed in the extended sigh, the outcry of the narrator, "Ah, she doth depart." The lover traveler, like nature's wind, does not speak in the language of denotation and definition, but in the language of innuendo and suggestion. Unlike the narrator's sigh of despair and defeat, the traveler's sigh is one of pleasure and of promise, which for Blake is the essence of love, since love opens the senses and the mind to the infinite. If the traveler's sigh corresponds to the gentle wind, nature's benevolent power, then the gasping, anxious sigh of the narrator corresponds to a failed imagining of nature and thus a constricted sense of bodily desire and love. These opposing sighs constitute the central metaphor of Blake's poem, and they remind us of the metaphor itself, which is the language that enables us to see things not merely as they are, but in the fullness of their open possibilities, always there to be realized through the marriage of inner and outer, mind and nature. As Blake says in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. Cross the road not taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though that, but passing there, had warned them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken, I believe, may be read as a series of sighs by the poem's speaker for his divided selves, the life he lived and the life he might have lived. The impossible wish for more than one life leads the speaker to seek consolation in the belief that the choice of his actual life has had positive significance. The speaker's first palpable sigh for the recognition of mortal limitation can be heard in the line, "And be one traveler, pause, long I stood." In that heavy pause given to the comma, which carries over into the stress on the word long, a sigh of regret is unmistakable in the speaker's voice, whose varying intonations constitute the fundamental metaphor of the poem. That voice is more complex and revealing than the relatively simple allegorical image of the two roads. The speaker attempts to persuade himself that the two roads can be distinguished, that a real choice can be made, but he catches himself and corrects that rationalization. Actually, both roads were the same, and both that morning equally lay, and leaves no step had trodden black. The speaker cannot convince him that a meaningful choice took place, and there is an extended sigh in that recognition, in the stressed O that opens the subsequent line against the flow of the iambic meter. Oh, I kept the first for another day. The first road is kept open by the poem itself, surprisingly, in its title, despite the later claim that the road he did take has made all the difference. The poem itself is what he will sigh for in the future, when he will again look back, for he predicts that I shall be telling this with a sigh. In effect, The telling is already told, but here the poem is projected into an indefinite future. When and where is somewhere ages and ages hence? Is the speaker imagining that he might be reciting this poem perhaps to his grandchildren as an intentionally misleading and therefore subtly comic parable about meaning in life when none is to be found? Or is the speaker imagining an afterlife in which the purpose of the journey of life is still obscure to him? If so, will his sigh then express eternal uncertainty? The reader only can follow the speaker's meaning here in speculation. The speaker, however, returns to the objective fact. Two roads diverged in a wood, though the detail yellow has dropped away, suggesting the increased remoteness of the perspective. The line break places another pause, another sigh, between the double self. And I took, separating one eye from the other, reinforcing the reader's sense of the sorrow of the speaker's divided consciousness. We hear his melancholy tone for being limited to one life in the breaking of his voice, his sigh, his troubled breathing, however we interpret them, are more concrete than any meaning the speaker can impose upon his experience. The apparently affirmative and individualistic claim, "I took the road less traveled by," clearly is contradicted by the facts presented in the poem. The two roads equally lay. They were indistinguishable, except for the historical fact that he took one and not the other. He cannot know what another life might have been, nor can he make a useful comparison. His statement, as he fully recognizes, is ironic, and that perhaps accounts for the prolonged sigh, which is the very telling of this poem. For it is a sigh which may go unrelieved in any future retellings, wherever ages hence they may take place. As in many of Frost's poems, the experience presented here is one of non-revelation. The wish for a revealed meaning or a proven significance, as in the making of a choice, is disappointed. And the reader can hear that disappointment in the speaker's voice, in the constrained, ironic bitterness of the last line. As Frost said in a letter to John Freeman, "A good sentence does double duty. It conveys one meaning by word and syntax, and another by the tone of voice it indicates." The words of the final line, "and that has made all the difference," denote that a meaningful and positive choice has been made, but the tone of voice undermines and reverses that assertion. In this steadily iambic poem, with only a few variations, the final two metrical feet are reversed. They are trochees, which give a full effect, all the difference. And in them, the reader can hear the diminishing of the speaker's voice. The last line is the only one in the poem that ends on an unstressed syllable, an exhalation of breath, a sigh fading into silence. The voice that speaks this poem, filled with the mysterious inflections of a sigh, is the accurate metaphor that corresponds to the narrator's experience of nostalgia for a revelation that never took place. The voice that speaks a poem, as implied by the written words, is itself a metaphor. And as in Frost's poem, what the reader learns or surmises from that voice may provide the crucial information of the poem. Voice inflections, pitch and speed, and voice qualities such as harshness or mellifluousness may be suggested, for example, by rhythm, rhyme, or the emphasis on vowel or consonantal patterns. Yet there is nothing more expressive in a poem than its pauses, its silences, for they evoke the bodily sense of breathing, easy or hard, and they may correspond to the idea of silence as absence, or at the other extreme, to an idea of silence as mental or spiritual inwardness. Look at Stephen's little poem now, Life is Motion. In Oklahoma, Bonnie and Josie, dressed in calico, danced around a stump. They cried, "Aho, aho," celebrating the marriage of flesh and air. Life emerges from silence and stillness and returns to them. The connecting interim is composed of sound and movement. Stephen's Life is Motion may be read as a little parable on this theme. In this poem, Stephens employs and distinguishes two aspects of language, imagistic and abstract, which correspond to physical presence and conceptual thought. Voice as sound object and word as idea. The letter O and the sound O are introduced doubled in the word motion. Person, dress, and place are related by having a prominent O letter and their implied sounds. Bonnie's and Josie's names have their O. Their state, Oklahoma, is filled with O. They are dressed in calico, and their cry, "Ahoyaho," which sounds like a caveman's version of Oklahoma, is a primitive warbling on the variance of the vowel O. The first two words of the title, Life Is, prepare the reader for an abstract and general proposition. And the word motion completes the concept. Although motion as a word evokes only an idea, not an image, it directs the reader's attention to the physical world of concrete moving things. And Stephens will not return to abstract language until the poem's concluding two lines, celebrating the marriage of flesh and air. For Stephens, every poem contains by implication the origin of language itself, the physical cry of the human voice not yet shaped into a word. As Stephen says in The Man with the Blue Guitar, the poem is the cry of its occasion. Inherent in the words and the design of the poem is the sound made by the rush of breath from the lungs through the throat, directed by the tongue against the teeth or the lips. This is the breathing voice that cries out, "Oh," in creaturely passion, either in pleasure or in pain. The letter O presents the idea of this sound, and in essence makes manifest what Stephens calls the poem of the idea within the poem of words, to which we should add in Stephens' behalf the poem of the idea within the poem of sounds. For as Stephens says in his essay, "The Noble Rider and the Sound of Words," above everything else, poetry is words, and words above everything else are, in poetry, sounds. The setting of the poem, listed by the calico clothing, is the 19th century American frontier. A farming family has taken time out from work for a celebration, probably a wedding. The expansion of the country westward and the clearing of the land for farming suggests life-affirming activity and energy. Yet the image of the stump, which appears literally at the dead center of the poem, 11 words before and after, count them if you like, produces a counter effect. The reader hears and witnesses a physical dance accompanied by a primal incantatory poetry around the central stump of death. Creation and destruction are thus seen as inseparable. The cry, "Ahoyaho, ahu," virtually is breath itself, pure voice unmediated by linguistic meaning. An emphatic breath pause is indicated by the ellipse, and in that moment as the cry trails off into silence, the reader-listener is invited to make the connection between the expressiveness of bodily voice sounds and the mind's power to conceptualize, to articulate ideas such as the idea of marriage. The poem thus presents the idea of celebration and is itself a celebration of the idea of marriage. The marriage of person and place, life and death, body and mind, and above all, of sound and poem. The poem is a metaphor for itself, celebrating itself, wedding the body's cry with the mind's linguistic design. It is a metaphor of the literal human voice transformed into poetic speech, according to Stevens' faith. Poetry exceeding music must take the place of empty heaven and its hymns. That is that. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. Illyrious freshness deep down things, and though the last lights of the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, ah, bright wings. The marriage of spirit and matter, word and sound, also constitutes the central gathering metaphor of Hopkins' poem, God's Grandeur. God's moral law is given to a man as a charge, which also may be seen as a charge of physical energy and light, as in the shining of shook foil. And the justification of God's divine authority is seen likewise as the creative manifestation of his power in nature's ability to refresh itself. The culminating image of the approaching dawn, transformed into a vision of the Holy Spirit as a descending dove, brings together a physical event and a spiritually enlightened understanding of that event, uniting the visible and the invisible. The speaker comprehends that human work is not sufficient unto itself. If not in the service of God and respectful of nature, God's creation, human activity obscures God's light and the world becomes bleared, smeared with trade. For Hopkins, the primary function of both work and language is to serve and praise God, and this obligation must be felt as well as understood, so that giving praise becomes human choice, not merely a duty performed out of fear. Seeing and understanding God's light, therefore, is not sufficient. Another aspect of light must be experienced, the warmth of light. And indeed, the speaker feels this warmth in the dawn as the warm breast of the dove, which is the Holy Ghost, perceived by the light of its bright wings. Light experienced visually is given through the metaphorical perception of physical images in this poem. But light experienced as warmth also requires its subjective response, its corresponding metaphor. Hopkins provides this metaphor in the bodily voice of the speaker, his cry of recognition and approval, the opening of the lips from their pursed O to the wider ah. The human voice, at its wordless or pre-verbal center, when given shape and meaning by the linguistic context in which it is placed, contains a responsive power capable of giving praise to God's initiating and creative work. In addition to visual illumination and felt warmth, light takes on as well the attribute of lightness, the body's divinely given miraculous power to rise. When the Holy Ghost descends to the bent world, and the speaker feels its warmth. The speaker's earthbound spirit unbends, and with a visionary leap, ascends heavenward with the dove, prefiguring the body's literal resurrection after death. Having been created from the dust by God's breath, man, the heir to his own self-bent, as Hopkins says, becomes unbound in giving himself over to God's will in the model of Christ's incarnation and death. As Jesus Christ's life and death, for Hopkins, is God's metaphor to inspire human understanding, to give the breath of faith to thought, God's grandeur, the poem itself, is Hopkins' metaphor in response from his own body and mind, his literal breath rising lightly in the word ah, speaking the language of the soul. The last poem I'd like to say a few words about. The sea elephant. Trundled from the strangeness of the sea, a kind of heaven, ladies and gentlemen, the greatest sea monster ever exhibited alive, the gigantic sea elephant. Oh, wallow of flesh, where are there fish enough for that appetite stupidity cannot lessen? Sick of April's smallness, the little leaves, flesh as leaf of you, enormous sea, speak, blow out, feed me, my flesh is riven, fish after fish into his maw unswallowing, to let them glide down, gulching back, half spittle, half brine, with eyes torn from the sea, in a practical voice, they ought to put it back where it came from, gape. Strange head, told by old sailors rising, bearded to the surface, and the only sense out of them is that woman's. Yes, it's wonderful, but they ought to put it back in the sea where it came from. Blow, swing, ride, walk on wires, toss balls, stoop and contort yourselves, but I am love. I am from the sea. Blow. There is no cry, save the two heavy body. The sea held playfully, comes to the surface, the water boiling about the head, the cows scattering, fish dripping from the bounty of. And spring, they say, spring is a coming in. William Carlos Williams, the sea elephant, is a poem spoken by a variety of voices. We hear the voice of the circus barker, an animal trainer, a lady at the circus, the sea elephant, the poet narrator, and the partially remembered voice of anonymous poet returning from the distant past. The two primary voices, however, are those of the sea elephant who cries out in frustration, hunger, and desire, and the poet narrator who, in effect, translates the sea elephant's expressive sounds into the language of conceptual speech, as when the poet, a circus trainer, says, speak, and the sea elephant replies, blow, and then the poet interprets blow as, feed me. The sea elephant's blow, there are many ways you can pronounce it, you can take your choice. The sea elephant's blow suggests the primal cry out of which eventually all speech will come. We hear an echoing resemblance of its sliding vowel O in the poet's exclamation, O wallow of flesh, even before the sea elephant speaks in the poem. The sea elephant is on show, but so too is Williams in composing his poem. Both in a sense are out of their element and have to struggle to perform in a new medium. The sea elephant on land, the poet in language. For the poet, identifying himself with the sea elephant as a fellow creature, only language heightened into poetic design can lighten the weight of the too heavy body. The crime of flesh, its voracious hungers, requires relief through the expression of itself in voice, and finally in poetry. Like the sea elephant out of the sea, which has been for him a kind of heaven, since it gives buoyancy to his body, human consciousness alienates us from the demands of our bodies, our unappeasable appetite. For the poet, that alienation may be overcome through his sympathetic and accepting identification with the sea elephant, an emblem of his bodily desires. So too their language must merge into one language, equally concrete and abstract. The poet's conceptual declarative statement, "But I am love," speaks for both himself and the sea elephant. This identification becomes explicit in the following line, "I am from the sea," and reminds the reader of the common evolutionary heritage of all creatures. Thus the repeated cry, "Bluau," also belongs to both the sea elephant and the poet, as it exists simultaneously as bodily cry and metaphorical word, expressing the carnal and the mental need for satisfaction. The human language is both voice and meaning, both physical gesture and idea. At the end of the poem, the poet narrator describes the sea elephant in his natural element, water, evoking again the imagery of his appetite for food and love as he comes to the surface. This power of appetite and desire is the creature's bounty, as the variety of conjured voices gathered together by the poem have been the poet's bounty, his circus performance of verbal images as if he were balancing on wires or tossing balls. His final description, "fish dripping from the bounty of," slows down and breaks off into perhaps a sigh, a deep pause, a silence. At that moment, the past, the cultural past of poetic tradition, floods back into his mind, so that the poet speaks not only in a creative voice, not only in his own voice, but in the voice of the history of poetry. The poem cannot end by drifting off into silence, as the ellipses suggests. For as Williams says in another poem, "Silence can be complex too, but you do not get far with silence. Begin again." Williams' poem begins again at the end, out of silence, returning to the thought of spring and an early memory of the tradition of poetry in English. His own contemporary voice merges with a voice from the past, just as his human voice merged with the animal voice of the sea elephant. The design of the poem, gathering these separate voices together, is itself a single metaphor, both making connections and expressing the idea of connectedness and continuity. The human voice of words and sounds, surrounding and shaped to silence, fixed in the poem's design, is the metaphor that also creates the continuity between nature and art, as if nature had found a voice in which she could express herself. Although the rest of silence, into which our lives will vanish, the moment of art may realize and thus make real the illusion of life as extended and intensified, an illusion in which we see ourselves truly as our own metaphorical creations.
Thank you.